Welcome back, everyone, to another episode of Lockdown Toronto. I really appreciate you tuning back in this week. And this week we have a great topic, and it's a topic I've been meaning to touch on for a while now. And it's on universal basic income, or its initialism, UBI. And I'm sure you've been hearing that term thrown around before. It's been taking some profile in the presidential debates even. And we're going to be running through this topic this week with my special guest. His name is Floyd Marinescu. He is the founder of InfoQ and QCon, a conference on software innovation, and also the CEO and activist for UBI Works Canada, an organization that encourages the support of universal basic income in Canada. Welcome, Floyd.
I'm glad to be here.
Yeah. So for those who aren't familiar with the idea of universal basic income, can you run us through the basics of what it is exactly?
Yeah, would be a monthly or weekly cash payment going out to all citizens, enough to cover basic needs, enough to cover poverty. We can have an economy that actually generates enough money for all of us to be above basic needs, to pursue higher opportunities in life, higher potential, better wages, better jobs. And there's generally two kinds of basic income. It generally means two different structures. One is a truly universal dividend, like giving us all a share of the economy, which is a flat amount that goes to everyone. And another kind is called a guaranteed minimum income, where the less you have, the more you get. And that's generally seen as an anti-poverty program that could replace other welfare programs. So these two together are both called UBI. Andrew Yang ran on UBI, $1,000 a month for everyone. Presidential candidate, United States. He calls me the Yang of the North, but I'm not a politician. I'm just a concerned citizen that thinks that UBI is actually the way of the future for an economy that can actually generate a dividend for all of us, making us all, in effect, shareholders in our economy.
So in essence, it's similar to what the CERB program, the Canadian Emergency Response Benefit, that has been going out since the start of the pandemic. It's similar to what Canadians have been receiving so far, except that it's guaranteed. You don't have to go through an application process or whatnot. It's essentially doesn't matter. I mean, there's the one that you spoke to where it's tied to your income and progressive based on that, or it can just be a guaranteed monthly or biweekly or weekly source of money that's provided. Before we get into the nuts and bolts of it,
yeah,
what made you become an advocate for universal basic income in Canada? And, I mean, if not only just to get the moniker Yang of the North, because that's a pretty good pretty good title to get out of all this.
I think so. I'm a trained computer scientist and also CEO of a mid-sized Canadian business, and you can kind of see the writing on the wall. If those who've actually taken the time to look at economics trends in the last 40 years, you can see that actually jobs aren't working for most people. Wages are not keeping up with cost of living. The middle class is shrinking. We're effectively becoming a two-tiered society. And that's a deep concern to me, because an economy that works well, it should be moving people up the middle and not increasing the size of a share of low-income jobs. And it wasn't always this way. So it wasn't this way before the invention of computing and robotics. And you can see it literally every recovery, every economic crisis we've had since the mid-70s, by the time computing and robotics were now mainstream, literally left earnings potential worse for most people. So at first I heard Elon Musk talk about it, and I was just amazed, like, wow, we could have a society that has all the innovation, all the freedom inherent in our system right now, but yet everyone can be above poverty to actually pursue their potential and not be stuck in unsafe environments. And that really struck a chord with me personally, because I grew up in a house with domestic violence. If my mother had a basic income, she would have had the opportunity to leave. She would have had at least more respect, because when people know that other people have options to take care of themselves or to leave easily to an unsafe environment, it changes the power dynamics. And I'm seeing actually an environment now where power dynamics are shifting tremendously, where we have most Canadians don't have more than 3 weeks of savings, and jobs are, people are working two or three jobs, working 60 hours a week. The 40-hour work week is a joke. It doesn't really apply anymore, because in the gig economy, you have to take whatever you can to get by. So I'm seeing society, frankly, regressing, with inequality becoming to huge extremes, and that's dampening economic growth and dampening the opportunity for people to have a better life. And the purpose of an economy is to uplift people, is to make people, give people more money and more spare time. And I see UBI as the way that we make the economy work for people again.
Yeah, so I'm old enough to remember, and I'm probably much older than you are, and I'm old enough to remember that at the onset of the computing age, when computers became widely available, they started becoming ubiquitous in office environments, that there was this giant promise of a productivity gain, where we would be able to do more with less, and that would give us more free time, and therefore result in less a less need to work. And essentially what we saw was the opposite, where productivity increased for sure, but so did work hours, so did connectivity and your attachment to your work and your work blending into your personal time. And that didn't tie with the income trends that we saw. The median income became flatlined at least for 30 years, 40 years even. I think it was the 1980, I think it's almost similar to what it was
in the mid 70s.
Yeah, mid 70s, early. Yeah. It's insane that that has been allowed to happen over this period of time with so much innovation, so much productivity, and the productivity gains have been realized by the upper 20%. And why not, instead of advocate for a universal basic income, why not just simply advocate for better redistribution of these productivity gains?
Well, that is what universal basic income is. It gives us a share of the economy. It allows us to organize ourselves to all benefit from increases in productivity and economic growth that are no longer driving wage increases. If you recall, since 2008, we had a 12-year economic expansion with unemployment reaching 40-year lows, and wages were still not going up for most people, just for like the top 20, 30% of earners. That's not an economy that's working for people. And UBI is how we turn that around. It's my belief that the old programs of just more jobs programs, more typical investments in infrastructure are not going to be enough when so much can be done by computing and robotics. So it's just not going to work. We need another means of sharing in the gains from technology, which I would argue is our common wealth. Earned income is just not enough to meet aggregate demand.
So I agree with that, and I'm just going to go through some of the before we go into the nuts and bolts of it a little bit more about how it actually works. I want to go through some of the, play a little bit of devil's advocate here, because there are a lot of criticisms around what it is, or even just based on first perceptions. And so UBI would be primarily tax-driven in terms of being generated by a taxation on the upper end of the income spectrum, would it not be?
That's right. In our plan, we put out a plan called Recovery UBI. We see the key to a fair and faster economic recovery to be implementing a basic income. And in our plan, we actually showed eight different ways to pay for it, eight completely ideologically different ways to pay for it. There's no excuse that we can't pay for it. And if you go to ubiworks.ca/recovery or slash how to pay, you can see our eight ways to pay. And please sign our petition, because we want to get to 100,000 signatures and create a voting block that will change the next election. So in our eight ways to pay, it definitely depends on how, what is the tax system that you would use to fund this. And we want taxes that would better approximate economic productivity, better approximate how the economy is growing. And actually, in our ways to pay, most of them don't involve changing personal income taxes.
In order to dispel the whole notion that some might have of UBI as being just another tax and spend program, can you maybe explain a little bit more about the origins of UBI, maybe as a fringe idea? Then it started becoming adopted by some tech titans, and even fiscal conservatives were very much interested in a UBI program, and why UBI is different from the typical government-driven social programs that it might be attached to or become connected with in respect to its origins, where it gets support on the political spectrum, and why that's unique.
Oh, the origins can go back many hundreds of years, back to Thomas Paine, one of the founding fathers of America. who believe that we should actually have a land value tax because people putting fences around land, preventing others from hunting there or subsisting on it, they should pay a rent, and that rent should go back into people's pockets as a, in effect, a universal basic income. As recently as 1968, it almost passed in the U.S. Congress twice under Nixon. It failed only because Democrats thought it wasn't generous enough. That's a time when Martin Luther King Jr. Was actually campaigning heavily on a guaranteed livable income as a way to uplift all races to be above poverty, so we all have it. We can all emancipate and have a better future. So imagine if we had passed the basic income in the United States in 1968. Pro-free market economists, Milton Friedman, on whose ideas like the modern system is based, he was for a basic income because he saw it as more efficient than a patchwork of government welfare programs that try and police you and control you and make you wait in line and waste time and have bureaucrats controlling you. Instead, let's just have a tax system simply refund people cash when they're below a certain amount, and if you're above that amount, then you pay out a bit more through taxes like we already do. The libertarian economist Friedrich Hayek was for it from a purpose of balancing power dynamics. Libertarians value freedom, and what kind of freedom can we have if we're financially insecure? So he saw it as a way to ensure that the vulnerable are not exploitable in a pure market system, because it's obvious that in a pure market system without some counterbalances, eventually have huge power dynamics and power imbalances, which we frankly have today. 12 people in the United States have over $1 trillion of net worth. And how do they get that? They got there through network effects. Network effects means you getting involved in Facebook, you buying Uber rides, buying stuff on Amazon. Once you pass a certain critical mass, these companies get so big that they can just take over and take out Main Street and take out hundreds of thousands of jobs, replace them with far fewer jobs than they're creating. So we're all part of this economic system, and we can all benefit from it. So it's been an idea for a long time. And I actually think that if we had had it in 1968, we would have had a much, much better society now. Because right now, we're passing through something called the Fourth Industrial Revolution. What does that mean? Manufacturing jobs, 4 million manufacturing jobs were automated away in the early 2000s. And a lot of despair followed those 4 million people. Half of them couldn't go back to work. They didn't find work. Half of those went on disability. The same thing is happening to call center workers, to retail workers. You can see it when you go into any local store. Same thing is happening in banking, because artificial intelligence and back-end office computing is taking over and replacing many jobs, becoming far more efficient. Same thing will soon happen to truck drivers, where there's billions of dollars being invested in self-driving trucks. And economists who have studied the issues have shown that when jobs are displaced through the technology, people end up moving into other industries that have a lower labor share. What that means is, if you look at one particular economics metric, how much money is created every year in a country that goes to working people versus goes to capital, meaning to shareholders who invest it. And it used to be that every year it was going up more and more to working people, because you needed people to match the economic growth to produce things, until after the invention of computing and robotics in the late 60s. And then we saw it from the mid 70s, the reverse, with more and more money going to capital instead of to working people across all OECD countries. This is a trend that's not going to end well. How far can it go? So the more the labor share decreases, the lower wage increases we can expect, and the more money that will be going to shareholders.
So just to circle back a little bit in terms of the original question I asked, where it sits on the political spectrum, and I want to get to a bunch of the other points that you addressed there subsequently. But there's also this concern where fiscal conservatives and economists such as Friedman lent support to it because they saw it as a way to get smaller government, similar to a flat tax, where there's a simplicity, it can be easily calculated into market and transaction costs, and because of that, they were in support of it. But that's also because they fully understood, and some people also, some critics to conservative support of UBI, also understand that there is something called a clawback rate, where other government programs, other social programs that are a bit more targeted to certain demographics or certain needs, tend to start being clawed back after UBI is introduced. Can you explain to us what clawback is and why some critics see the clawback of programs as UBI. Some critics see UBI as a Trojan horse to claw back current programs that work for people.
Yeah, there are some senior advisors to Trudeau who have tweeted that UBI is a conservative Trojan horse. Frankly, it depends on who implements it. I mean, a sword can be wielded for good or for bad, depending on everything's double-edged sword. So in the recovery UBI proposal that we put out a few weeks ago, we actually pose this as a top-up. Everyone gets $500 a month more immediately right now on top of any other payments. And on top of that, we top up people who are making less than $2,000 a month. Up to 2,000, and there's no clawback. There's only a top up, and we think that that's a faster way to introduce this economic stimulus, help with our recovery, help people have time to invest in greater outcomes in their lives, and allow for months and years later for consolidation of programs. So clawback means many things in different domains. So a typical guaranteed minimum income, again, which is not the same amount to everyone. It's where the less you have, the more you get. Typically, it works like this. We all would have access to $2,000 a month as an income guarantee. But for every dollar you make in earned income, you lose 50 cents of that benefit. So if you're making over like $50,000 a year or something, you wouldn't actually have anything out of the $2,000. But if you're making $30,000 a year, you might have you would have like $15,000 more of it. It's a wage boost for people in working poverty, and that's really important because the market has simply not delivered high enough wage increases for people in the bottom half. So either model of basic income solves working poverty. When two-thirds of people in poverty are working, like that's an abomination. How could that be? You're working and you're still in poverty. So both programs solve that. But the clawback would be 50 cents on the dollar of earned income versus that would be removed from your benefit. The word clawback can also be used in another context where there's a concern that, let's actually look at what happened with the Canada Child Benefit. So before the Harper government, the Liberal government at the time was about to implement universal child care across the country, modeled after what happened in Quebec. So, mm-hmm. And Harper came in and said, we're not going to do this new public service. Instead, we're just going to give everyone $150 a month for child care. And that's what they did. So they had a very small dividend that replaced a program that could have actually been worth tens of thousands for people who needed it with a very small cash amount. That is what people on the left are very concerned about, that mm-hmm. a basic income could be used as a justification to cancel really important public services, just giving people money. Like I remember some Republican in some debate saying, yeah, we're going to give people vouchers for hospitals. Vouchers? Where the heck is $500 going to take you when you have to go get an operation? It's a joke.
Market fundamentalists love the idea of vouchers because it's all about, for them, it's all about choice and enabling private sector wealth gain.
So let's take this example a bit further. We went from canceling a public service to create a very small basic income for people with kids, which is kind of a meaningless amount. And then the Liberals got in power and they made it progressive. So they made their own basic income that was very progressive, where the poorest families get up to $560 per child per month. That's a lot of money. And the clawback, there is a clawback on that amount, so much so that even if you're making $100,000 a year, you're still getting like $100 a month or something per child. So it's progressive in that, again, the less you have, the more you get out of it. So those are both basic incomes. One is progressive, one is a very small, trivial amount. So that's why, for example, if you look at Andrew Yang's $1,000 a month proposal, he was arguing that if you're receiving any kind of government support right now, you'd have to trade that for $1,000 a month. You would decide if you're better off with $1,000 a month. So in effect, what that meant was that you'd have to get off welfare and take $1,000 a month and not work, or get a job and keep $1,000 a month more. So in that case, the clawback is 100%. If you're on welfare, you're trading dollar for dollar for $1,000 a month. Mm-hmm. And that's an example of a 100% clawback. But honestly, like, it depends on what the program design is. So in recovery UBI, which is at ubiworks.ca/recovery.
Don't worry, I'll link all the information in the show notes below. And because it's super important for people to understand exactly what this is, so that when you hear this idea filtered, and I'm talking to the people watching, but when you hear this idea filtered through the talking heads elsewhere, and getting political spin in maybe a 14-second clip on some yelly head show, you'll understand a little bit better about what this is, because that's the point of this program. We want to go through this a little bit more in depth, and you will have plenty of opportunity to check out in the links below some more information on this stuff. But sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt, but it's important that people know where they can get their.
Yeah. So in our proposal, we framed it as a dividend of $500 a month for everyone, plus a $2,000 income guarantee. So no one makes less than $24,000 a year, no matter what. There's really no clawback in a sense. Under $2,000, we're topping you up to $2,000, and then beyond that, in the years to come, assuming this got passed, then there could be common sense consolidations that could take place. So what would that actually look like? It could look like the cashed parts of other government programs that are currently provincially administered, like people on disability or people on Ontario Works, for instance. That dollar for dollar could be provided by a federal program instead that doesn't have all these trade-offs and loops you have to jump through and forms to fill out. But the in-kind services parts, like getting social working help coming to your house, access to therapy, a wheel trans bus that takes you to work, like those things would be maintained by the provinces, because we don't want to lose really important in-kind services. Those cannot be compared to just a pure cash outlay.
Yeah, and in that sense, it's also important to understand that this cannot be also a supplement for future policy initiatives. But again, there's always that fear there. But another fear is that, and this is one that is a little hard to flesh out, just because there hasn't been a total example yet of where this has been applied on a national level, in a wide ranging economy. If I'm not wrong about that, not yet anyway. But the idea about inflation. So the notion that, okay, fine, you start paying let's say everyone gets $50,000 a year at some point, the cost of basic goods will rise simply because you're flooding the demand side of the market with cash. They're going to be flush with cash, therefore the cost of goods will go up. Can you address this basic point?
Yeah, well, first let me address what you said before this question, because it leads into this. There is a national scale basic income in the world, and it's actually in Canada. It's called the Canada Child Benefit. Right now, for the last 3 years, over 400,000 families have been receiving more than $1,000 a month. Over 1 million families have been receiving more than $600 a month. That's like a basic income for some people.
But it's not universal, right? I personally could not opt into that. And plus, there's an application process that serves as a bit of a check to those who it would apply to. So, but I understand your point with it. Sorry, continue.
Well, my point is that over $24 billion a year was injected into the economy through this program that primarily helped low-income people. And what happened from that? So there's actually been a study by the Canadian Center of Economics Analysis that showed that for every dollar invested, it created $2 of GDP growth, that the Canada Child Benefit drives almost 500,000 jobs. It added 2.1% to our GDP, almost the size of the province of Nova Scotia's economy. And it creates three times more of that in business revenues, $85 billion in business revenues created by consumer spending from this first 24. And 55 cents of every dollar spent comes back to the government in terms of taxes because of the economic activity generated by the Canada Child Benefit. In the last 3 years, we haven't had any problem with inflation. And in the last 12 years in the United States, they printed trillions of dollars. There's been no impact on inflation. So why would we think that giving hundreds of billions of dollars to bankers and businesses would not cause inflation, but giving $100 billion to people would? Let's break down what inflation actually means. Inflation is a factor of supply and demand. Do we think Amazon and China can't scale up to meet our demands for basic goods, basic foods? We're in a globalized economy. There's enough being produced everywhere that if one country implements a basic income, it's not going to make a nudge on inflation. The only area where there might be a slight inflation issue that I frankly needs more study, I think, is maybe the very low end of the housing market, but just the very low end, not all ends, because most people already live somewhere now.
There's no such thing as a low end in Toronto. Sorry to say. They're all like $1 million and up. But yeah, there's no such end thing as a low end.
So everybody market, already, almost everyone already lives somewhere. We're not drastically increasing the demand for housing versus the supply.
Right.
But I do remember that being at a conference on basic income a while ago and asking people who were in the Ontario pilot, what would you do if this pilot lasted 10 years and not just two? And all of them said we would move because they're all living in really crappy housing and they wanted something a little bit better. So it's possible there might be some inflationary effects on slightly better than absolutely terrible housing. But then after that, maybe past a certain point, I would expect market dynamics to come into play and there to be healthy competition, just like in any other market.
And that's always been my my counter argument. One, just because you subsidize the demand side of the market by injecting cash into the economy doesn't necessarily mean inflation will go up, similar to injecting billions and trillions of dollars into the supply side of the economy through banks and other corporate subsidies and bailouts doesn't cause inflation to go up either. And I agree with you on that point. I think it's kind of a facile point to be honest, because, you know, supply and demand end up evening out anyway.
Generally not new money. If it's paid through taxes, you're not creating new money. You're just circulating money in a smarter way.
Yeah. And the way I also put it to people is that, there's a reason a hockey draft happens. Hockey draft happens because you don't want to have the richest teams picking up the best players all the time, because the league would suck and then it would collapse after the team wins time and time and time again. And economy is exactly the same way. If in the economy, the top 20%, top 10%, top 1% keep getting the gains year after year after year after year, the economy becomes top heavy and eventually it will collapse, or at least lead to instability. So at some point we have to reimagine what it is to create a stable economy, because the purpose of the economy is not to create entities that just accumulate wealth year after year after year. It's the efficient distribution of resources, because demand and supply and competition in the market create efficiencies. And when you have a scarcity of goods, you want efficiencies in the market. But if the market is distorted to the point where it enables the wealth of the top tier to constantly gain year after year after year after year, it's like a hockey draft where the richest team keeps getting all the best players. After a point, it will collapse. And UBI one of those things where it could be a stopgap, or not even a stopgap, but a solution, a real tangible solution to that. But moving on a little bit, the idea of, I asked you earlier about the national scale level of this, but there was a pilot in Toronto, in Ontario, under the Wynn Liberals that was initiated. Can you talk a little bit about that and why the PCs ended up scrapping it?
It's funny because that scrapping the pilot is what kind of activated me as an activist. It just really made me angry. Yeah. I was so proud that Ontario had this world-leading pilot. The whole world was watching. It was a very important pilot because I think over almost 5,000 people were going to participate in it across several cities in Ontario, Hamilton, Brantford, Lindsay, and a sprinkle of people around Toronto. And you had these amazing stories, people starting small businesses, people going back to school, people buying their first winter coat that they could ever have afforded, people eating vegetables for the first time in a long time. Like, this is incredible, incredible stories. And I think, frankly, that's why it was canned. I was actually surprised that an experiment created so many stories in the Toronto Star. I think that's actually why the PCs canned it, because it was already halfway through. It would have cost us another $50 million or so to complete it. That's like a drop in the bucket. I think they canned it because they couldn't deal with all the good news stories that could be used against them in the next election, since they couldn't fathom how they would implement, they'd ever campaign on a basic income, even though basic income in many ways is a conservative idea. Right? Yeah. But so that's just, I think that's why it was actually canned, because it makes no sense to do it on a cash basis. And that pissed off a lot of people, including myself. It really turned me into an activist. And what I did is, I, being a business owner and a CEO myself, I got 100 other CEOs to sign a letter to Doug Ford asking him to not cancel the pilot and laying out the economic case for a basic income. And you can read that at ceosforbasicincome.ca. So yeah, that was a very important
120 or so Canadian CEOs signed that one.
Signed that letter that basically said, this is urgent. It's good for the economy. It's we need to do something about automation and globalization and the gig economy. And we had a big launch at Queen's Park, but it didn't ultimately change anything. But it did surface the talking points that the business community is for it. And actually recently, when COVID broke out, CEOs from Alberta for immediate income support for Canadians.
Yeah, so you cut out a little bit at the end there, but the point was well taken. So in terms of the pilot getting canceled, there are other examples, though, of pilots being done. Alaska is another example that we could look at, where they don't necessarily have a universal basic income, but they do have a dividend, right?
In Alaska, they share oil revenues with their citizens, and it's become such a sacred program that neither Republicans nor Democrats will touch it. It's just a foundation in the economy, and it's been shown through economics research that is not so. If you can get $2,000 a year, I believe, through the permanent dividend fund in Alaska. And it's been shown to have no negative impacts on labor force participation, but although it's actually increased part-time work by 17%, which is actually quite interesting. And I think that's an untold story with basic income, that more people could actually afford to work part-time while attending to other responsibilities in life, like caring for the elders or caring for their kids. And that's actually, I would see that as an advance in society, if people could afford to work a little bit less and use their basic income for the rest.
Yeah.
Over 105,000 people have been in basic income trials, over 16 trials in the last 50 years, and there was no negative impact on work, except for in some cases a second earner, the partner who stays home to raise the kids, or high school students who actually finished school, so they didn't jump into the job soon enough, and those are the kinds of examples where there was less work. In Brazil, for many years, there's been a program called the Bolsa Família, which gives cash to the poorest of families. That also had a $2 GDP contribution for every dollar invested, reduced crime significantly. There were experiments in India and Namibia where they saw entrepreneurship increase by 40% because people actually had a chance to now emancipate, a chance to take risks. This is a very important point, is that innovation, economies and jobs are created by innovation. New ideas, solving new problems for humanity. Like, that's what makes capitalism actually work well. And innovation requires taking risks. And we're in a situation where more than half of the country, or in all Western countries, just is living check to check because wages haven't been going up, and automation is one of the main reasons. So how can we take risks when people are living check to check? Basic income would unlock our risk-taking potential. I think would be a huge injection of entrepreneurship and innovation that we frankly really need right now.
Yeah. And I agree with a lot of that. And we also have the opportunities of places like Spain and Germany now starting their trials with universal basic income. Obviously, the idea of the pandemic has given the palatability of UBI to different nations around the world a greater energy. And so UBI has gained a lot of momentum because of the current unknowns in the economic forecasts and futures of many nations. Can you speak a little bit about their programs? And I don't know if you're aware if they faced any political resistance or if it was just a unilateral kind of thing, or...
I believe Spain is doing something that's more like in Brazil. It's a somewhat conditional cash transfer for the poorest of families. It's not really a basic income, but it resembles it in that you're giving cash to people who need it, as opposed to, like, you know, all these other working conditions. In Germany, it's actually a crowd-funded campaign that's going to give a basic income to, I think, a few hundred people. So it's not a major experiment like the Ontario pilot. That was a major experiment with 5,000 people. Or the one that ran in Dauphin, Manitoba in the 1970s. That was a major experiment. A whole town got a basic income and they, for 5 years. And a lot of people were going back to school. People were starting new businesses. Hospitalization visits fell by 8% because people were less stressed. The experiment that happened in Finland that just concluded recently actually gave several hundred people who were already on welfare €500 a month or so, which is not really basic income, but it is a little bit more income security. And they found a very small increase in employment for those people. But they also found extreme decreases in stress and increases in trust and a sense of civic engagement. And that's even for just $500. There's been so many trials. Like I said, 105,000 people have been in trials, and there hasn't been a decrease in work. So I think the research is out. It's time to implement this.
Yeah. And so going back a little bit to the technology side of this, given that so many corporations and giant wealth accumulating firms like the Amazons and whatnot, that they are multinational corporations, and they could easily just, you know, take their business to another country, register it in another country, pay taxes in that country in order to avoid responsibilities, the tax burdens of a UBI implemented in one country and another. How would that work? How would any government try to combat that kind of activity, the capital flight activity that we would probably see if you suddenly put a 20% tax on Amazon?
Well, that I assure you that flight's already happening. Anyone who can afford an international tax structure is already doing it, and adding another 3-4% or even 10% to various taxes is not going to change anything. I mean, Amazon already in the United States, where it's headquartered, pays zero federal income taxes. So, adding a basic income, I don't think is going to change very much. There are taxes that can actually reclaim some of our economic activity and keep it in this country, like increasing the GST. There's a reason why most European countries have their HST equivalent GST is like over 20%. It's because they're sandwiched between US, China, Germany, Japan, and that's how they can keep more of their economic activity contributing to localized tax revenues and not have it all just disappear. So there's also been tax proposals that would specifically target these platforms. I believe the Liberals were floating one around. In the UK, there was one floated around to put a revenue tax on the foreign tech giants, because profit is easy to hide, but revenue is not easy to hide. And in fact, within the United States, I know this because my business operates in US and Europe and other parts of the world. In US state, if you have a business there, whether you're incorporated there or not, you have to pay a share of your revenues into that state if you're actually serving people in that state. That kind of tax regime is really smart, and frankly we need that on an international basis.
So going down the road a little bit more on the political level, has there been any political support? You touched on a little bit earlier about how some Liberal Party strategists were shooting down the idea of universal basic income because it's a conservative Trojan horse, which is kind of a convenient excuse to ignore calls for it. The current CERB program, Canadian Emergency Response Benefit, is ending in September, which is going to put many people into a precarious position. The employment insurance program has been boosted a little bit, and there are a bunch of other programs that they announced as kind of stopgaps. Do you see any palatability or any support among the various parties, or even people within the various parties, for UBI? Who are they, and have you even spoken to anyone of them regarding UBI?
Yeah, there are many MPs who, on an individual basis, within the NDP, the Liberals, and even the Conservatives, are for basic income. Their parties are not officially for it. Only one party is officially for it, and has been for a while. That's the Green Party. Despite what you hear about the NDP, Jagmeet Singh never called for a permanent basic income. He only called for one in the context of the pandemic as a short-term response. Right now, there's a motion. Motion 46 was tabled before the government was prorogued by an NDP MP named Leah Gazan, and she put up a petition to support the motion at 35,000 signatures. Nathaniel Erskine-Smith, who's in downtown Toronto core, has been for basic income for a long time. He's very public about it. Bruce Stanton, a conservative MP, I forgot which riding he's from. He's for it. He's spoken up publicly for it. And actually, one of the long longest running advocates for basic income in the country is Hugh Siegel, who was a former conservative senator, and he personally designed the Ontario pilot. So there are like a lot of support among MPs, but none of the parties except for the Greens have officially come out for it. And there's a lot of political reasons why that's the case. So what UBI Works wants to do is raise an army of Canadians who are a visible voting bloc that will be undeniable and be all make all the parties scared to not run in the next election. Because I've always believed that basic income is an election, requires an election mandate. If you're going to raise taxes, you got to run this, promise people something, and get voted in. I don't think the Liberals can just do it unless they're going to really play a masterful political game with the whole throne speech stuff coming in the next few weeks. Because effectively what they're going to do is they're promising some huge shift in their social safety system, which social welfare system, which sounds like it could be basic income. And they're basically going to say, all right, other parties, you're either with us on this, because we have another, you know, two and a half years to go in this in power, or call an election now. Let's play chicken. And if you call an election now, then you're going to be opposed to this program. Canadians will know it, and we're going to run an election on this issue. So it's actually kind of a strategically very interesting move. So I hope they're going to be for basic income, because if you watch Chrystia Freeland, our new finance minister, if you watch her TEDx talk from like 8 years ago, she knows in that TEDx talk that the economy is no longer driving wage growth and prosperity for most people. She talks about the plutocrats. She talks about automation affecting jobs. Like I haven't heard any politician ever speak so intelligently about economic trends that are affecting working people, except for her and Andrew Yang. So I hope that she's for basic income. She's never admitted it.
Well, given her discussions in the TED talk, or sorry, TEDx talk, and how close she is to the ear of the Prime Minister, let's hope she's talking him into being a little bit more supportive of it. But I only see trend lines going up in terms of the momentum for this, especially because there are so many unknowns, especially when the weather changes. We don't know if we're going into a second wave of this. Even the business community I did a broadcast of a bunch of episodes ago about how even small businesses in Toronto were just shuttering doors, because of the unknowns around this, and a permanent, financial benefit would go a long way to assisting that. Where do you see in terms of pre-pandemic, during pandemic, and maybe right now where we are in kind of a holding pattern around the pandemic, did you see support just on your radar? Do you see support for UBI going up among Canadians? And would you attribute that to the current situation that we find ourselves in? Or would it be more along the lines of people watching American politics and seeing it through the presidential debates? Yang of the South, as we would maybe refer to it as.
Certainly both. I mean, Andrew Yang raised awareness of automation and the impact it's had for a whole new generation. He discovered narratives and talking points that are very centrist and are not too left or too right, and I think that's a huge contribution. But here in Canada, I mean, we have our lived experience. Over 8 million Canadians received something like a basic income, and it didn't make them want to work any less. In some cases, it did, because a basic income, the CERB, is actually more like welfare than it is like basic income. You lose it when you go to work. So some people had to make a decision for what's best for them with the months of CERB that they had. The basic income is different. You keep it when you go to work. You build your income on top of it. So why wouldn't you want more money? So, but at the very least, I think 8 million Canadians, working Canadians, had a chance to experience what a basic income could be like for themselves. And I think this will be a very important voting block for the future. And I think millions of us will not have jobs to go back to as the pandemic lifts, because we are in the fourth industrial revolution in fast motion. Businesses are automating to survive. We're already in an economy where the stock market is reaching highs. Meanwhile, so many people are out of work. Mm-hmm. Already in an economy where you can get Amazon packages delivered in the same day when millions of people are out of work. So clearly the economy is working without most of us. We're not even needed for this economy to work well. And that's what an industrial revolution looks like. It looks like a huge transition to new jobs, a few of them that get paid better, while old jobs get completely devalued. People get shut out of the system, get shut out of opportunities to better themselves because their skills are no longer valued because technology is cheaper than workers. And right. It's only going to get worse and a lot faster.
So let's say UBI becomes DOA in the next few years politically. Where do you see automation impacting the economy in specifically a Canadian context in terms of the automation? Where are the sectors that are specifically at risk?
Well, it's easy to say truck drivers, right? But I think most people don't realize that, back office computing has had a huge impact on jobs. I mean, when personal computing came in and spreadsheets was the death of the secretary. There were millions of people doing admin jobs that were no longer needed with the invention of spreadsheets, with the invention of cloud computing, mobile. Like, there's just huge swaths of millions of jobs don't exist now that would have existed 20 years ago, given the current amount of productivity that we have. So this is more like this stealth thing happening in the background. And in some cases, you can see it, like when you walk into a McDonald's or you walk into, various coffee shops, you see all these kiosks you can order from. And you might remember what it was like when there was like six people behind a cashier's. Now there's just one and a bunch of kiosks. You might see that in some cases, but most of the job loss we don't see because it's due to artificial intelligence. It's when you call Rogers and you're talking to a chat agent that directs you to the right answer before you speak to a human being. Like, that's happening everywhere. So the overall impact of automation in the next coming 10, 20 years, where 40% of the tasks we already do at work can be automated today, I think will be just an extrapolation of what we've seen in the last 40 years, which means stagnation of wages. Well, meanwhile, cost of living continues to go up. People's personal debts continue to increase because they're just not making enough to make ends meet. And life just gets harder and harder for most people, while a few people at the top are raking in everything because automation lends itself to winner-takes-all economics. We can see it everywhere. When 12 people have $1 trillion of net worth in the United States, that's winner-takes-all economics. So it's just going to be continuing death by 1,000 cuts. And if we're lucky, we might see a certain sector lose their jobs fast enough that there is rage and there's something that you can actually see. If truck drivers end up doing roadblocks or something like that because they're competing with self-driving trucks, we might actually see it happen quickly enough to realize what's going on. But in general, automation happens more in the background, and we can see it in the lack of wage growth that we've had.
Wow. Dystopian future ahead. I'm very tech forward and I love technology, but I also understand the impact that it has on the process of people's jobs. And hopefully with UBI and it being implemented or being adopted in a more political context in Canada in the near future, we will be able to realize that productivity dividend that we were promised in the 90s and the 80s when the computers first began being implemented in offices.
Well, the dividend's there. Yeah. It's going to capital, not to workers.
right, exactly.
So in some ways, UBI is like capitalism for all. We all get capital income, which is income we didn't work for, but we have an interest in.
Yeah.
It makes the economy pay us all in dividend directly.
We all get first round draft pick at some point, right? And keep the draft going and keep the league going because that is the goal. I mean, the goal isn't just to create circumstances that allow for wealth accumulation. The goal is to keep the system and benefiting all. And keeping it stable and afloat. And of course, some instability and risk is encouraged, but we're supposed to smooth those rough edges a little bit in terms of what kind of society and country we want to live in and we want to see our children grow up in. Floyd, I really appreciate you coming on the show. This has been a super important topic. There was a lot of information there for people to digest. I'm going to go through it this evening and try to make sure they have links to all the information that they should be privy to in the show notes below. But in case I missed something, is there anything that we didn't touch on that you would like to address, or even places where people can go to find more information on whether on you or the program?
Yeah, I mean, UBI Works, we have a long-term commitment. Our goal is to see UBI being a defining election issue in the next election, no matter when it is. So if you sign up on our mailing list or sign our UBI, Recover UBI petition, we'll be in a conversation for the next like two, 3 years, however long it takes. We don't want to stop until we see this happen, because we see this as a basis for a better economy, an economy where automation and all these trends are actually benefiting all of us, where we can all have more disposable income. We can actually go back to 40-hour work week or even a slightly less for people. Like, that's what an economy should do. Like, the efficient organizational resources is for the purpose of human upliftments, and we need to get back there.
Actually, before we end off, you brought up a good point. There has been also a thrust for a 4-hour work week. Is that something that is tied in with some energies around UBI? Is it seen as in competition with UBI? What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah. Well, first of all, Tim Ferriss talks about the 4-hour work week.
Sorry, not the 4-hour work week. I read that book way too much, but I mean the 4-day work week. People online are going to give me grief for that one.
The 3-day weekend. Yeah. Why shouldn't we have it? All right, let me give you a bit of a futuristic flavor.
Yes,
so
please.
The economist John Maynard Keynes, who lived in the early 20th century, his ideas formed the basis of the modern world's post-World War II recovery, like a huge towering figure in economics, said that by today, we'd all be on a 15-hour work week because productivity would be so high. So if you unpack that for a bit, how do we know we're not already there?
That's exactly it. You're right. I hear a lot of stories of people just simply doing busy work in their offices. Meanwhile, they get their work done in like a six hour, their whole week's work done in 6 hours.
So the fact is that we can't regulate our way to a shorter work week. Even if like the most left party imaginable tries to make a 35-hour work week, most of the new jobs being created are contract and gig. People will work as much as they need to cover their basic needs or more.
Yeah.
So what we need to do is actually put money in people's pockets so they can choose to work slightly less. Yeah. It would be a cruel joke to have a 35-hour work week or a 30-hour work week for full-time salaried people when the Uber drivers are doing 60 because they have to feed their kids. So UBI is the only way we could get to a shorter work week for people, just through personal choice, not through regulation. And I think that's how John Maynard Keynes is realized in real life, circulation of capital in our system, so we can make better choices for our lives.
Floyd, before we start, before the internet goblins start gobbling up our feeds here, because we're cutting in and out a little bit, I want to thank you for coming on the show. I really appreciate you. It's a great last point. And where can people reach you online if they want to follow you? Do you have an online presence that people can get in touch with?
Best is to follow UBI Works on Twitter and Facebook, and join our email list off ubiworks.ca. Thanks.
Perfect. Thank you so much, Floyd. And that's the show, everyone. Thank you for tuning in. I really appreciate you sticking with us. And for those who want more information on UBI Works, I will be linking it in the show notes below. So make sure you check that out. Sign up. It's a super important thing. And it will transform the way we live and the way we work. Until next one, we'll keep in touch.